Good morning. Can you do better than that? Okay. Good morning. Welcome to the First Parish of Stowe and Acton, a welcoming Unitarian Universalist congregation. My name is Scott Feldhusen, and I've participated in a lot of different things here. I'll just put it that way. Our Reverend Dr. Cynthia Landrum is not in the pulpit today, but today's service will be led by a special guest who has a long history with First Parish Church. Laura Wagner, MSW, is the executive director of UMass Action, which is the state action network for Unitarian Universalists in Massachusetts. Her role is to organize and mobilize UUs to confront injustice and to provide opportunities for us to live our values and principles. Laura has been a Unitarian Universalist for 25 years. She actually brought up her family here. I can still picture her little kids running all over the place. During this time, she has held many lay positions, but her main primary focus has always been social justice. Everyone is invited to coffee hour in the fellowship hall after service. To get there, please exit the church through the door on my left and follow the hallway to the end, go down the stairs or take the elevator, and follow the arrow to fellowship hall. Child care is available during the service if the need arises. At any time during the service, please feel free to take your child there where they will be well cared for. The nursery is located in the lower level of Fellowship Hall, which you get to the same way as the Fellowship Hall, but down one more level. If you're not sure where to go, one of the ushers will guide you. On most Sundays, we have religious education classes that children will depart for after the first part of the service. Please see the order of service for more information. If this is your first time with us, we're happy to have you here. Please sign one of our guest books, which are located in the vestibule by the front entrance of the church or at the visitor's table at coffee hour so we can put you on our mailing list for our newsletter and announcements. Thank you for your attention. At this point, please put your cell phones, and I'm not going to put mine on, but put your cell phones onto worship mode and take this opportunity to greet your friends or friends-to-be. Thank you.
Welcome to worship today. It's a joy to be with all of you. Here are our opening words for you to consider this morning. May we be reminded here of our highest aspirations and inspired to bring our gifts of love and service to the altar of humanity. May we know once again that we are not isolated beings, but connected in mystery and miracle to the universe, to this community, and to each other. Welcome. And I invite Scott, thank you so much for lighting our chalice this morning. Our chalice lighting comes from Reverend Christine Robinson. We gather this hour as people of faith with joys and sorrows, gifts and needs. We light this beacon of hope, sign of our quest for truth and meaning in celebration of the life we share together. I invite you now, as you're willing or able, to join me in singing hymn number 318, We Would Be One, and rise as you're willing and able. invited to remain standing and join me in saying our covenant together. Love is the spirit of this church, and service its law. This is our great covenant, to dwell together in peace, to seek the truth in love, and to help one another. So the verdict is there's not a lot of kids in this service, but since it's a story for all ages and this is a fun group, we're doing it anyway. So in order to tell the story, I need four helpers. So is anybody willing to come up and help me tell the story? It involves puppets. Excellent. Come on up. We need a chicken. Do you want to be a chicken? And we need one more, a mouse. Thank you. Okay, so this story is about these friends who have lived in neighboring farms in a little village for a very long time. And they enjoyed great harvests and time together and plenty of food for their family, and things were good. But over time, because of climate change, the weather patterns started changing, and they noticed that their springs were colder, and there was more rain, and so it took them it was much later before they could get their seeds in the ground, which meant a shorter growing season. And then in the summer, it was hot and dry, and there was a drought often, and that would kill a lot of the plants, and they didn't get as many vegetables as a result, so they were starting to get less and less food, and they were getting worried. Worried, so let's show them how they're worried. So then... So what they decided to do is each one on their own, alone, decided what the real problem was and what a solution could be. So Pig went off and decided, you know, I think the spring is the problem, and that what we need is we all need to get a greenhouse so we can start our seeds early, and then we'll have strong plants to put in the ground when the rain finally stops. So Pig got to work on that and researched all these greenhouses and started calling his friends together for meetings, and not a lot of them came, and some liked the idea and some didn't, and Pig got frustrated and said, nobody cares about this like I do, and just went off and kept working on her own. Well, while this was happening, Cow said, no, I think what the problem is we need more water in the summer, so we need to build irrigation ditches and bring water from the river to our crops. So Cow got busy on that, but it was really hard for Cow to manage the shovels and needed help, asked for help, and again, got some help, but not a lot, and got frustrated and just kept working on her own. Well, while this was going on, Chicken said, oh, you're both silly and wrong. What we need is better seeds. Hold up, Chicken. We need better seeds. So Chicken got to work going through a phone book and calling seed companies, but Chicken only has little wings, and it was really hard work for her to do. So she asked for help, and again, got a little help, but not a lot of help. So the three of them started arguing about which person had the right solution, and it was made Mouse over here very sad. Mouse really loved her friends and said, I don't like seeing them arguing. I don't know what to do. How do we pick which one's most important? So she decided, you know what? I wonder what our neighbors are doing in the next village. So she went over to the next village and found out what they did. And what they did is they made one greenhouse that they shared, they pooled their resources, and they did start seeds early, and that really helped. And the seeds they found, they contacted their friends in the south who said, we have heirloom seeds that are really great in drought and don't need a lot of water and are doing well. Why don't you use some of our seeds? So that's what they did. And then they put rain barrels up to collect all that rain from the spring, and when they needed it in the summer, they were good to go. This is brilliant. So Mouse went running back to her friends and told them what she learned. And at first they said, oh, what? I've done so much work.
you want me to be an expert on everything. I can't do everything. I can only do one thing. And she said, no. What you can do is lead the part that you like the most. So, Pig, you can organize us and help us build one greenhouse together that we'll share. And Cow, since you were most focused on the summer drought, you can help us build the rain barrels so we can collect rainwater. And Chicken, we'll give you this number. You can call our friend in the south and help us get some of those seeds, too, that do much better in this new climate. And they said, you know what? We like that much better than arguing. So they hugged each other and celebrated their newfound solution and got to work. Excellent job. Take a bow. Excellent job. Thank you.
During Black History Month, the month of February, our church will be joining the UU churches of Concord and Sudbury, as well as the synagogue in Acton, in reading the names of lynching victims in the United States. The point of this observance is to honor the memory of those whose lives were so unfairly cut short, as well as to encourage us to be aware of racial violence that still exists in our communities, our nation, and our world, and our opportunity and responsibility to be the change we want to see in the world. There is an insert in your bulletin that shares more about this observance and the names that will be read each Sunday. We've done this in a way to be accountable to people of color by receiving counsel from Black Lives UU, which is the organization with which we share our plate today, and with the Maynard Anti-Racism Alliance. As we enter into a time of reverent observance and listening to the names that are read, I offer this quote from the National Memorial for Peace and Justice in Montgomery, Alabama. For the hanged and beaten, for the shot, drowned, and burned, for the tortured, tormented, and terrorized, for those abandoned by the rule of law, we will remember with hope because hopelessness is the enemy of justice, with courage because peace requires bravery, with persistence because justice is a constant struggle, with faith because we shall overcome. And I'd invite Rick Lent to come up and read the names.
William Hardy. Jesse Slayton. Jim Cruz. Whit Dillard. Elijah Strickland. On June 29th, in 1905, in Oconee, Georgia, the following eight black males were shot multiple times for various alleged crimes. Claude Elder. Gene Yerby. Louis Robinson. Lon J. Alcock. Richard Allen. Richard Robinson. Robert Harris. Sandy Price.
As we enter a period of meditation and prayer and reflection, I invite you to consider these words by W.E.B. Du Bois, and then we'll have a period of silent meditation. Now is the accepted time, not tomorrow, not some more convenient season. It is today that our best work can be done, and not some future day or future year. It is today that we fit ourselves for the greater usefulness of tomorrow. Today is the seed time. Now are the hours of work, and tomorrow comes the harvest and playtime. As you bring your attention back into the room, I invite you to hold on to that feeling of scented peace and carry it with you forward through this week. Today's reading it's an excerpt from a longer speech given by Naomi Klein, titled "Let Them Drown: The Violence of Othering in a Warming World." Scientific studies warn that we face the loss of all coastal cities and most of the world's large cities and all their history, and not in thousands of years from now, but as soon as this century. If we don't demand radical change, we are headed for a whole world of people searching for a home that no longer exists. The thing about fossil fuels is that they're so inherently dirty and toxic that they require sacrificial people and places. As recently as the 1970s, scientists advising the U.S. government openly referred to certain parts of the country as being designated national sacrifice areas. These policies are dependent on theories about the people who live there being, quote, so poor and so backward that their lives and culture don't deserve protection. Turning all that coal into electricity required another layer of othering, too, this time for the urban neighborhoods next door to the power plants and refineries. In North America, these are overwhelmingly communities of color, Black and Latino, forced to carry the addiction to fossil fuels with markedly higher rates of respiratory illness and cancers. Even without such dramatic events, this kind of resource extraction is a form of violence because it does so much damage to the land and water that it brings about the end of a way of life, a death of cultures that are inseparable from the land. A recent Truth and Reconciliation report called it cultural genocide, the trauma associated with these layers of forced separation from land, from culture, from family, is directly linked to the epidemic of despair ravaging so many First Nation communities today. The Australian government detains survivors of wars and despotic regimes in camps on the remote island of Nauru and Manus. Conditions are so desperate on Nauru that in May of 2016, an Iranian migrant died after setting himself on fire trying to draw the world's attention to what was happening there. Another migrant, a 21-year-old woman from Somalia, set herself on fire a few days later. Malcolm Turnbull, former Prime Minister there, warned Australians that they cannot be misty-eyed about these events and that they have to be very clear and determined in their national purpose. In another bit of symbolism, Nauru is one of the Pacific Islands very vulnerable to sea level rise. Its residents, after seeing their homes turned into prisons for others, will very possibly have to migrate themselves. Tomorrow's climate refugees have been recruited into service as today's prison guards. We need to understand that what is happening on Nauru and what is happening to it are expressions of the same logic. A culture that places so little value on Black and brown lives that it's willing to let human beings disappear beneath the waves or set themselves on fire in detention centers will also be willing to let the countries where Black and brown people live disappear beneath the waves or desiccate in the arid heat. When that happens, theories of human hierarchy, that we must take care of our own first, will be marshaled to rationalize these monstrous decisions. The point is that this could have been a moment to understand that we are all affected by climate change and we must take action together in solidarity with one another. It wasn't because climate change isn't about things getting, it wasn't, sorry, because climate change isn't about things getting hotter and wetter. It's under our current economic and political model, it's about things getting meaner and uglier. The most important lesson to take from all this is that there's no way to confront the climate crisis as a technocratic problem in isolation. It must be seen in the context of austerity and privatization, of colonialism, of militarism, and of the various systems of othering needed to sustain them all. The connection and intersections between them are glaring, and yet so often resistance to them is highly compartmentalized. The anti-austerity people rarely talk about climate change, and the climate change people rarely talk about war or occupation. We rarely make the connection between the guns that take the black lives on the streets of U.S. cities and in police custody and the much larger forces that annihilate so many black lives on arid land and in precarious boats around the world. Overcoming these disconnections, strengthening the threads tying together our various issues and movements is, I would argue, the most pressing task of anyone concerned with social and economic justice. It is the only way to build a counterpower sufficiently robust to win against the forces protecting the highly profitable but increasingly untenable status quo.
This month, as I said before, we share our plate offering with Black Lives Unitarian Universalism, which is an organization working to expand the role and visibility of black UUs within our faith. There's information about BLUU in your order of service. With thanks, this morning's offering will be gratefully received.
Somebody's hurt my brother, and it's gone on.
Oh.
That was beautiful. Thank you. I invite folks now to join me in singing hymn number 123, Spirit of Life, and please stand as you're willing or able. It's wonderful to be here with all of you this morning. Thank you for inviting me. I'd like to begin today by sharing some reflections on our current political and social environment. And this may be a bit depressing at first, so I hope you stay with me. But it's very important that we have some context when we're thinking about the change that we need in our world today. Then I'll offer some reflections on our social justice successes as a reflection of our values, principles, and faith. I'll also share my vision with you for how we as a faith community can work together effectively to create the change we wish to see. Out of respect to our ancestors, I'd like to first offer this prayer. Let us call forth and honor the ancestors of the indigenous people who first lived on this land, those whose lives and the lives of their descendants that were forever changed following first contact. And let us call forth and honor the countless souls who have journeyed to this land, those who came willingly and those who did not, those who saw this land as a beacon of hope and those who were terrified to learn what would happen to them here. We call forth and hold this energy to help us gain clarity and to understand the times in which we live. May it be so. What I love about being a UU is that our values and principles are the stars that guide us. Symbolized by our beacon of light, we recognize that beautiful words are meaningless unless we breathe life into what we profess to believe. I recognize that we're not perfect, but that's okay. Our vision must be bold, and that means quite often that we are going to fall short. If our goals are easy to achieve, then we have set the bar much too low for ourselves. Our ideals are a beacon of light calling us to grow into our best selves. In the words of American folklorist Zora Neale Hurston, we must jump at the sun. We may not land on the sun, but at least our feet will get off the ground. At UU Mass Action, our mission is to put our faith into action and create a world in which all people are honored and valued. We are one of 23 state UU action networks across the country, and we work to organize and mobilize UUs in Massachusetts to confront oppression. We're engaged in multiple direct action projects, and we also engage in advocating for legislation that will create that positive systemic change that's needed to have an impact on our communities statewide. Legislative advocacy work can be exhilarating when we achieve success, but it's often terribly depressing work that produces feelings of frustration and despair. And often this is due to the brokenness of our democracy. The legislative process has a theoretical way of operating, which provides an opportunity for residents to participate in democracy, but then there's the reality of how it really works. The frustration and despair results from the corrupting influences that have eroded our democracy. This is the depressing part I mentioned earlier, so I hope you stay with me. For a deeper understanding of the changes that have occurred in our political system over the past 50 years, I highly recommend that you read Daring Democracy by Francis Moore and Adam Eichen. This was our Common Read selection from, I believe, 2017. The authors present an analysis of the functioning of our democracy both at a national and state level. In 1945, Aldous Huxley said, "All that we are and will do depends, in the last analysis, upon what we believe the nature of things to be." And what is the nature of things? The authors of Daring Democracy mark the beginning of the anti-democracy movement as 1971. They state, "On the 23rd of August, soon-to-be Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell, a former head of the American Bar Association and at the time serving on 11 corporate boards, wrote a 34-page confidential memo commissioned by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Its purpose was to outline the strongest possible response to what Powell perceived as a growing attack on corporations and the free enterprise system itself. 'It is in deep trouble and the hour is late,' Powell warns. 'The time has come, indeed, it is long overdue for the wisdom, ingenuity, and resources of American business to be marshaled against those who would destroy it.' His dismay seemed rooted in a perception that corporations were being unfairly treated, and he writes that few elements of American society today have as little influence on government as the American businessman, the corporation, or even the millions of corporate stockholders." The authors go on to state, "What appears indisputable, however, is that the Powell memo served as a playbook for the ensuing campaign to elevate private power and to undermine public voices, a multifaceted effort ultimately funded and guided by some of the wealthiest families in America." Another influencing factor from this period of time was the Southern Strategy, which began in 1968 when it took shape during the Nixon campaign. Ari Berman, author of Give Us the Ballot, wrote, "In 1968, Richard Nixon premised his own campaign almost entirely on winning the white backlash vote. The strategy was to stoke racial resentment during the Civil Rights era to shift white Southern Democratic voters to the Republican Party. A tactic in this pernicious narrative, especially in the ensuing decades, was the use of dog whistles, i.e. coded political messages that convey specific meaning to selective audiences, in this case, whites. It was during this period that a tremendous shift in the functioning of our democracy occurred. Following the Powell memo, there was an increase in some of the country's wealthiest families using their vast fortunes to influence policy, shape our beliefs, and change the very nature of our democracy." The authors of Daring Democracy define these strategies used by this developing concentration of power as command the narrative, delegitimize democracy's norms and institutions, quietly create a parallel political operation pushing anti-democracy message with hundreds of front groups, community by community, and build big donors' common purpose and coordinate their efforts to achieve the three strategies I just mentioned. Sound familiar? There are other influencing factors noted in Daring Democracy that have their roots in the shift in power set in motion by the Powell memo and the Southern Strategy. Some of these include Supreme Court decisions such as Buckley versus Valeo in 76 and Citizens United in 2010, which allowed the voice of the wealthy to drown out the voice of virtually everyone else. An army of special interest lobbyists in Washington, D.C., and yes, there are organizations such as unions that lobby too, but they are outspent 34-1 by corporations. Public interest groups make up 1% of total lobbying spending, while businesses make up 75%. And more, we're seeing the middleman being cut out, and corporate-backed candidates are entering government directly. The current administration's cabinet's total wealth equals that of a third of American households combined. A third. There's a lot more detail I could go into, but I think for now you get the point. There has been a growing concentration of wealth in this country, and it's directly related to the growing concentration of political power. And yes, things are bad at a federal level, but what about here in Massachusetts? That's not quite as bad as D.C., but we do have our challenges here, too. But this is where being a faith community is so powerful. Our values and our principles are the foundation that shapes our vision. Our commitment to justice is not based on party loyalties or self-interest, but as Reverend Dr. William Barber states, there are some issues that are not left versus right, liberal versus conservative. They are right versus wrong. We need to embrace our deepest moral values and push for a revival of the heart of our democracy. We are called to be bold. We are called to hear the voices of those who suffer most right here in our Commonwealth, and we must act. We must not be swayed by dog whistle language and coded political messages that prey upon our fears. No, we must remain grounded in the values and principles that we hold dearly and not accept a narrative that we know to be false. It's not going to be easy. A story comes to mind that reflects how difficult this can be at times. My husband, Ken, is a volunteer driver at our local senior center. One day he was giving a ride to an elderly woman who was born in Austria. The conversation turned to her concerns about the current political climate, and the woman stated that the news she reads increasingly reminds her of the conditions she experienced in Nazi Germany. The two discussed her observations, and then the conversation turned to the crisis being faced at our southern border here in the U.S. To this, she replied, "Yes, but we can't let them in. They're all bringing in drugs." I was so disheartened when Ken told me this story. How could a woman who lived through the horrors of Nazi Germany not see the parallels between the propaganda used to demonize Jews and the propaganda now being used to demonize thousands of refugees and asylum seekers fighting for their lives here in the U.S.? Fear is a powerful influence that compels us to believe a narrative that we know to be false and betray our own values. Brian Stevenson, author of Just Mercy, teaches us about the importance of proximity when engaging in social justice. We must witness the reality of a situation ourselves and listen to those who are most directly impacted. We are responsible for not letting fear and ignorance shape our understanding and drive our actions. The change we call for needs to be bold. Our actions need to echo the words of Zora Neale Hurston, and we must jump for the sun. We are long overdue for our congregations to move away from issue-based organizing and engaging solely in charitable acts and towards movement building. At UU Mass Action, we have transitioned to movement building approach, which recognizes that no one issue stands alone. And I'd like to elaborate this concept by beginning with the climate crisis. The climate crisis and the rise of global temperature is shrinking the amount of arable land needed to sustain human life. In Africa, an estimated 65% of arable land is now too damaged to sustain food production. 65%. In Syria, extreme drought in Syria between 2006 and 2009 is directly linked to the violent uprising that began in 2011. And in India and Pakistan, extended periods of deadly extreme heat are making large, densely populated regions unbearable for the people who live there. Without drastic change, millions more people are going to be forced to migrate. An additional concern, of course, is flooding. As the polar ice caps melt at alarming rates, the seas will continue to rise and cover low-lying islands and large coastal regions. Not too far in the future, people living in these regions will also be forced to migrate. And how might these people who will be forced to migrate from their no longer existing homes be treated? If the current treatment of migrants is any indication, not so good. How is immigration and migration, forced migration, tied to mass incarceration? Well, the prison industrial complex is not going to go quietly into the night as activists succeed in changing the policies that drive so many people into the prison system. In Massachusetts, we succeeded in passing landmark legislation last session that will have a significant positive impact on reducing the prison population. But over the last three legislative sessions, we failed to get even basic protections through to protect vulnerable immigrant communities. The Department of Homeland Security issued a directive this summer for ICE, which is Immigration and Customs Enforcement, to increase daily immigration arrests and detentions from 40,500 to 51,000 a day. The policy results in an unprecedented amount of people being imprisoned in detention facilities and in our local county jails, which are only too happy to meet the demand. Correction officials are not concerned if their prison beds are filled with people being held pretrial, convicted of nothing, or convicted of a crime, or if the person is an immigrant detained by ICE. They just want those beds filled. Prisons divert a lot of money from our state budget, money that is desperately needed to invest in infrastructure to help us meet clean, renewable energy goals. We will never end fossil fuel consumption if our elected officials don't even prioritize this as a goal. Individual behavioral changes are just not enough. We need commitment to statewide systemic changes in our energy policies. So where do we start? We could start with our corrupted democracy. During the last legislative session, climate and immigrant rights activists were certainly disheartened and discouraged. We only got a tiny fraction of what we wanted to move forward on our 100% clean renewable energy platform and by achieving those goals by 2050, and absolutely nothing on immigrant rights, nothing, not even a protection of a person's due process, nothing. A particularly painful piece of climate legislation that was a failure was an amendment which would have established a commitment to environmental justice. It was gutted by the Senate chair of the Telecommunications, Utilities, and Energy Committee, which is a very important committee to move any climate bills through. The Senate president in that committee struck down the language identifying race and ethnicity or income as a factor when addressing environmental justice, his justification being that he felt all communities should be protected, by completely ignoring the history of injustice suffered by communities of low income and people of color. One of the biggest determining factors of whether your child will have asthma in this state is what your zip code is. Some of the other frustrating moments of this past legislative session included being told that climate activists were asking too much and that we should only choose one or two bills, or that they're very busy and they can't be expected to work on everything. But this is where activists, we need to come together and think differently about our priority and what we expect from leadership. In the summer of 2016, Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org, challenged us to declare a war on climate change and mobilize a response like that which we saw during World War II. We need that type of bold, no holds barred, everybody rowing in the same direction kind of response. This is a global scale crisis, and our response needs to reflect that. Our response as UUs need to reflect that. It is unacceptable to work for years only to get minor changes, and we get in our own way when we argue about which is more important. Do we get people out of prison, or do we work on climate change, or do we work on economic justice, or immigrant rights? It's all part of the same picture. We need to understand that big picture and get to know how our piece of the puzzle, where we can contribute to change, how that fits into the bigger picture. We dilute our power when we latch onto one bill and see it as the panacea to a problem to the exclusion of all else. We dilute our power when we want to define the problem and solution on our own and refuse to work collectively with our community partners. And we dilute our power when we exist in coalitions that work in isolation from everything else. Imagine what would happen if progressive coalitions joined forces. The Poor People's Campaign, led by Reverend Dr. William Barber, calls for this level of bold action. The authors of Daring Democracy calls us to create a movement of movements, bringing coalitions together to create a bold, unifying platform. And I know this can seem overwhelming at first, but I love this statement by John Silver, who's the founder of Represent Us, who says, "We can love reminds us that we can love two children at once." We do not have to be experts on everything and attend every coalition meeting, but imagine our power if we really understood the true dynamics that influence our democracy. If we work together to create that bold platform of demands and centralize our power in a way that dilutes the power of the big money opposition, this can happen. At the end of the previous session, climate and immigrant rights activists came together really for the first time on shared actions and began coordinating together. We saw the shift in power that this created. In fact, between the two of us, we helped slow down the budget process last spring for 2 weeks, the two coalitions. UUMass Action is partnering with Adam Eichen, who's the co-author of Daring Democracy, and we have convened and are in discussion with our fellow organizers in climate justice, economic, criminal justice, immigrant rights activists, all coming together to explore the same brick wall we hit when we get to our legislative process in the state. I don't know whether you saw it, but we had a vote. We tried to get a vote for more transparency through this, what's called when they get the new people settled in, there's what's called the rules. They vote on the rules in the House and the Senate. And they actually voted against transparency. Things like we asked that legislators should know what they're voting on and actually read the bill. And as constituents, we should know how our elected officials are voting. That all got voted down. We are beginning to explore how we can move forward on that, and there there's a growing movement, and the new class coming in is very receptive to bringing more transparency to our governance, which is so important. It's actually a very exciting time for social justice in our state. Politely playing by the rules that powerful corporations do not follow, is over. There is too much at stake, and too many people are suffering. I'd like to leave you with these words by political activist Angela Davis. She says, "I'm no longer accepting the things I cannot change. I'm changing the things I cannot accept." Reverend Dr. Barber refers to this time as the period of third reconstruction. Let us recognize the significance of the time in which we live and work together to create a world that truly honors and values all people. Maybe so. I invite you now in joining me in singing Stand As You Willing and Able, and join me in singing hymn number 168, One More Step. Alert, stand firm in your faith, be courageous, be strong, let all that you do be done in love.